Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On Immortality. For more information and news we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. Hey!
Hello, my geek geeks!
Another episode of Geeks On.
Welcome back.
It's been so long.
Yeah, nice.
And this one's not tied directly to a summer movie.
I know. It's been so long since we've actually talked.
Well, you know, they're rolling out so quickly, and geek movies these days is every movie.
I know. Well, it's actually a subject to talk about as a side note.
Yeah, you know? That when a Woody Allen movie comes out, it's a weird anomaly.
Yeah, like right. Yeah. Something that used to be considered mainstream is now strange and unusual.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. But it's also one of the things that's being blamed for this summer's collapse of the movie market. You know, it's just the sheer volume of major motion pictures coming out.
Right. Well, I found that most of the blockbusters actually this year haven't been terrible. But they're just sort of B-level mediocre.
They are
There's nothing that's jumping out, really, that's gotten me really excited.
Well, and they're all sort of adjacent to something that you kind of feel you've seen before.
Yes. Well, they're all sequels, almost.
Well, even if you haven't, like Pacific Rim, right? I don't feel like I've seen Pacific Rim on the big screen. But when I'm looking at the trailer, it's kind of Godzilla meets Transformers. So I've
there's a lot
seen
of Top
before.
Gun in there.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that definitely too. A lot of Top Gun.
Yeah.
There's a scene in Pacific Rim that I turned to my friend and was like, "This is the exact dialogue from Top Gun,"
which, by the way, is not a good movie to strip dialogue from.
No. You know, I'm pretty sure there was like a badly written St. Crispin's Day speech in there too. I was like,
yeah. "Did we ever talk about Pacific Rim?"
We didn't. It snuck on by.
Yeah, yeah. To me, it was one of those super average movies that just didn't feel like worth a conversation.
The CGI was so great. Like, the fights were unbelievably cool.
And that's my problem, honestly, is that the fights were wonderful. And it just sort of made it very clear that there are these gems stuck in mediocrity. You know?
Oh, but yeah.
I want to push back on that a little bit.
The science is terrible.
I thought that the special effects were done technically right, but I thought that the design was average and the scenes were very junky. And I also thought the fight scenes were pretty boring as far as creativity of fight scenes.
Could you walk me through what you mean by junky?
Well, in other words, the scenes were there was nothing like beautiful about the shots. It felt like a lot of clutter on the screen, even though it was kind of amazing. Clutter, like lots of particles, lots of destruction.
Okay.
I didn't go, oh my God, that's amazing looking. And robot design, I'm sorry. I know that they were trying not to go down the anime road too much, but you're not even getting close to cool robots when it comes to like, there is anime, which is giant fighting robots.
Yeah.
And those designs are unbelievable compared to those things. I mean, they even had the big Russian tanky thing. I mean, that's kind of out of the box, first thought type of design right there.
Yeah. I mean, they could have definitely gotten more creative with the robot designs.
Because
it was really the main three or four robots that they did. And they just seemed like variations on the Gypsy Danger robot.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the one with the multi-arms is kind of cool, but I don't know. I just thought it was average when it came to that.
I'm going to go in a different direction with that. I would actually say, like, this, because you've seen those things, like, you know what to expect. But for me, this is the first time I've seen that live action, right?
Okay.
I enjoyed seeing that rendered that way, in a way where, like, those things looked real to me, and that I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And my problem with them was that they presented these things with great introductions. right? Like, here is the Chinese four-armed robot piloted by three Chinese acrobat brothers, and right. here's the Russian robot. It's the oldest one in service. It's so old, it's steam-powered with engineers in its feet shoveling coal.
Right.
You know, and it was this great build-up, and then they just walk into combat, and they get taken out so quick there's no flavor to them.
Yeah.
It's like having superheroes where you see the costumes and they don't do anything.
Right, right.
You know, that yeah. was my issue with
it. So you think that the other robots were just the red shirts?
Yeah.
They were like, eh, those, they're expendable.
And my problem with the red shirts was they were presented in a way to make them much more interesting than the two lead robots that went in and...
Yeah, they weren't red shirts design-wise, yeah. but when they yes. got out there, they didn't have personality when they actually performed.
When they yeah. fought. Like, what yeah. was it about those robots that made their fighting style different? You didn't see yeah. enough of
and
that.
Didn't, yeah, and I kept thinking, you know, through the whole thing, I kept thinking, you know, like... Okay, so they punch the monsters, and then the finishing move is always like the chest opens up and a cannon shoots. Why don't you just build a cannon?
See, my yeah. issue was that
and then the sword showed up.
That they were doing all the fighting with the cannons in the beginning, and then the sword showed up in the middle, and the sword was the most effective
yeah,
thing.
Cut them in like, half,
why
one
weren't
shot.
They using the sword the whole time?
Well, it's yeah. the Voltron syndrome. I'm like, why would you attack them as lions if the lion thing never works? Just freaking form the head and go kill it, you know?
Right. Yeah, they should have just all but carried swords and just sliced them from the, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean...
And honestly, like, I, as much as I liked all the fight scenes, all the acting scenes really,
oh,
really
awful.
Hurt.
Oh,
I don't know.
Just terrible.
Yeah. I don't know what happens.
I thought the little...
I love Idris Elba. I love Idris Elba. This
as
the first...
do I. And I love Guillermo.
Yeah. No, I you mean, know. It's two great tastes that should have gone great together, yeah. and I don't know what happened.
The little Korean girl was good. She was the best actress in the whole thing.
Oh, the yeah. The little
like the 12-year-old or the 8-year-old Korean girl who was like the
who was hiding and scared.
Yeah,
like
hiding
in
the scared.
Flashbacks.
You mean
yeah.
the one whose only line was "Ah!"
Still, she put out more
more
you know,
range of emotion,
more range
than
of emotion than the rest of them. So
than Charlie Hunnam.
Well, in case nobody actually knows, my name is Aaron Hendricks, and I'm a graphic designer here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek.
My name is Donald Marshall, and I am a video game professional, and I too am a geek.
My name is Brad Grusnick. I'm an actor and writer here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
Don't you like how we have cold opens?
Yeah.
Where we get into a little topic, and then we introduce
exactly.
ourselves.
Here's the teaser, and now we're going to get
yeah,
into
see,
the
see, that's
show.
Because we've done this so much. Yeah. We're so into this, we can actually do cold
we
opens.
We may right. be joined by Matt King, who is an actor out here in sunny Hollywood. He may or may not be en route. There is a microphone hot and ready for him?
Yes, there's a mic. In fact...
So if his voice magically appears in the middle of the episode, don't
I
freak out.
I should probably actually turn that volume down so we don't get echo over there. So I'm going to do that right now. Ta-da. Okay.
Let's try and remember that it's off when he sits down. Yeah.
So did we have an interesting geek week at all, or do we go straight into news? What should we do here? I'm trying to think what geek week I had. I work
I'm,
so much.
Yeah,
I,
I'm
yeah,
so,
I'm trying to, like, what geeky things
it's
did
three
I
three brain-fried
do?
Geeks just staring at each other blankly yeah, here. It's fascinating podcast. Now this is radio, people.
Yeah, exactly.
How was your geek week?
Explain, Brad, explain running charades.
Running charades. Okay, so my birthday was this weekend, and we had a little game night party. So running charades is essentially like regular charades,
mm-hmm.
but instead of two teams sitting in a living room and pulling clues from a hat and acting out to their team. Waiting for each other to do. Both teams are playing charades at the same time.
Nice.
Or more teams.
We played with three because we had so many people in the house. So what happens is one person from one of the teams becomes the clue giver. So mm-hmm. they sit in a central location, and the other three teams have to send members running to that central clue giver, get the first clue on that clue giver's list, run back to their teams, perform the clue, and guess it. When they guess it, that person who guessed runs to the clue giver, lets them know what the clue was, then they get the next clue on the list. So you go through a list of five clues. Everybody has made a list before you start playing the game. And everybody makes a list of five clues and then a theme, like how those clues are related. So the way that a team wins that round of running charades is they guess the five clues on the list and then guess how everything is related.
So they have to come back to the clue giver and give what the topic of the five clues were.
That sounds awesome.
A lot of running.
It's a lot of running, and it's frantic, and it doesn't feel like you're playing a boring sitting around party game. It feels like you're very active, and everybody is getting excited. And it's like, oh my god, I thought we had that, and then you did that crazy theme, and I didn't know what it was. And you know, I mean, some of my favorite ones was, you know, people gave a list of movies and nobody could get it. And finally, it was like an actor from each of those movies was one of the Avengers.
Oh,
so it was
cool.
Like Shutter Island, Natural Born Killers, Star Trek, and like Match Point. And like, okay, well, all right. So it was Mark Ruffalo and Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Hemsworth was in Star Trek. And
oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is what also Matt King did one that stumped everybody. I got it in kind of a flash of light, which was all movies that had Lee Van Cleef in it.
And I couldn't get his last name. I was like, it's Lee. It's the guy from Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
So you did get that
Lee,
part.
Lee. Yeah, I blanked on his last name.
Well, the thing that threw everybody is one of the answers was The Master, which is an old TV show.
Right.
But we all were thinking the latest movie.
And the one that threw me was one of the movies was The Octagon. And because I know Matt's a fight guy, I was like, oh, these are MMA terms, or
right.
These are MMA nicknames.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, the clues can be hard if you get somebody who's, you know, a sadist.
Nice.
Yeah.
That reminds me, like, when I was in New York, my friend's circle got addicted to celebrity, like terminally addicted. It was sort of absurd.
Uh-huh.
To the point where, like, we knew all of each other's celebrities. It was just ingrained. So we started doing concept celebrity. So it would be things like, you know, theory of relativity.
Mm.
Nothing. You know?
Loop. Art.
You know?
Right.
And
how do I act that out?
Yeah, it was just like, and you're not allowed to point at anything. It was very important. Yeah, that got vicious. That got really vicious.
Yeah,
that's unfair.
Oh, but awesome.
Now, there is I was explaining this to Don the other day. There is a new game that just got kickstarted, but it's been a print-and-play game for a little while.
I love this idea.
And you can still go and print-and-play. In fact, I'm printing them out now and starting to make the cards. It's essentially a new version of Werewolf, and apparently it's all over the conventions right now because it accommodates large, large groups. The theme can maybe be off-putting to some, but I don't think people who are... I think you're overthinking it if you get offended by this.
I think it's hard not to notice the theme.
Okay. The game is called Two Rooms and a Boom. Okay?
Okay.
And which is, I think, actually a pretty good game because it explains the game. So what you do is you have a whole bunch of cards, just like Werewolf.
Yeah. Everybody has a role.
Everybody has a role. Yeah. But the general one is everybody has like a villager role, which is nothing. And then and there's two teams. There's a red team and blue team. You don't know who's on. So there's villager blue teams and villager red teams.
Mm-hmm.
On the blue team, one of the people is a president. And on the red team, one of the people is a bomber.
Oh, my God.
Then you randomly go into opposite rooms, okay? And you elect a president, or you elect a leader, okay, in that room.
Uh-huh.
And that leader, after 5 minutes of discussion and stuff, that leader picks a certain amount of people, each room, and they're called hostages. They send them to the next room, to the other room. So you exchange people. Then you do another round of 4 minutes. The leader, could be the same leader, or you can elect a new one.
Yeah.
Then sends another group of four, or however you exchange rooms. And you keep doing that for five rounds. a 5-minute round, 4-minute round, 3-minute round, 2-minute round, a 1-minute round. At the end of that, everybody reveals their cards. If the bomber is in the same room as the president, the red team wins. If the bomber is in the opposite room of the president, the blue team wins.
Wow.
And the other great thing about this game is that you don't need a storyteller because everybody's involved with the game.
Yeah.
I have not played this game. Mm-hmm. I really like the
mechanic. I can see how it would be offensive.
Yeah, there needs to be some twist to it, though. Like, I can't quite figure out what
you
that is.
You are allowed to show parts of your card. Unlike Werewolf, you can show parts of your card. So you can just say, like, I'm blue team. Or you can show your entire card to somebody if you want to.
Okay.
So you just have to risk whether you're showing it to the wrong person or not.
Yeah.
There's also then 50 roles that you can add to the game. Like, there's a role just that's simply just called shy, which means you can't show anybody your card, even if you want to.
Even if you want to.
So you can claim, oh, sorry, I'm shy, but you don't have to be.
Sorry,
you can
always... I'm a shy bomber.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, there's all these different roles to change up the game. I'm curious to try to get it to this one played, although I think you need about 10 or more people.
I would say, it sounds like you need a big group of people to play the game.
Yeah, and that's why it's a big convention game, because I think a lot of people can play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like a fun one.
Yeah.
So I did something that I haven't done in a long time that I thought was fun. It opens up a question to the two of you.
Okay.
I had a bad movie night with one of my favorite bad movies of all time, Hawk the Slayer.
Yes.
Oh, nice. Have either of you seen
this?
Oh,
yeah.
I have not. I've heard of it, but I have not seen it.
Oh, it is the stuff of legend. It is Jack Palance at his scene-chewing best, attacking a nunnery filled with bad-acting British nuns. Basically, it is a movie filled with people whose accents are completely randomized.
Nobody sounds the same.
No, nobody sounds the same. Like, there's a Midwestern guy, there's a high British, low British, like, there's a Southern guy. There's no rhyme or reason. A couple of these people went on to actually become recognizable actors later in their career. The lead guy actually is Jack's father from Lost. Somebody recognized.
Yeah. Oh, right.
It's so weird. The worst photography, but, like, brilliantly done. And apparently the entire thing was filmed while they had just a bumper crop sale on dry ice. Just there's smoke
there's just
machines
fog
going
everywhere.
Crazy. It's wonderful. So out of curiosity, what is the best? Because, you know, this was sort of hot on the heels of Sharknado.
Yes.
You know? And I did see a clip reel of the best scenes from Sharknado. And
was there anything on the list on the clip reel?
I'm fascinated to see it. Just people with chainsaws catching sharks in midair. I mean,
it's been on my DVR since it became a phenomenon.
I'm curious,
I don't want to watch it by myself. It's like I want to get a group
I'll bring
of
the popcorn,
people together.
Man. Yeah. So, what are your favorite good bad movies or enjoyable bad movies?
I don't know if Zardoz still fits that list.
I mean, Sean Connery in
diapers.
Furry underwear,
yeah.
You know.
I actually think that movie has some merit, though, so I don't know if it completely fits.
I've got a
By
couple,
the way, I'm going to
yeah.
bring this up later in the podcast, Zardoz.
Zardoz. Okay. Hard Ticket to Hawaii.
Oh, I have that
hard
on my...
Hard Ticket to Hawaii.
I bought
I
that from Matt.
I don't think I've seen that.
That movie is one of the best worst movies I've ever seen. I mean, obviously there's like The Room and Troll 2 and, you know, those are terrible and sort of in the pantheon of best worst movies.
Troll 2 fascinates me.
Yeah, there's actually the documentary Best Worst Movie about the making of
that.
Troll 2 is a really good documentary about making a terrible movie.
Oh, to sum up for people who aren't familiar with Troll 2, is a movie about extra-dimensional vegan trolls who attack Earth in order to turn humans
into
plants so that they can eat them.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are no trolls in the movie. Everybody is goblins, and the name of the town is Nibblebog. Nibblebog, which is goblin spelled backwards.
Yeah.
Weird.
So, yeah.
It's so strange. But yeah, Hard Ticket to Hawaii is just the typical, like, sexploitation, terrible like guns and people in like terrible 80s clothes and just ripped dudes and just women with just like their shirts coming off and just like the
lead of that movie works in my building.
Really?
He's on a soap opera.
Oh, nice. Wow. But yeah, I mean the dialogue is terrible, the acting is awful. There's a bunch of scenes that just don't make any sense.
And it's got a razor blade frisbees.
Razor blade frisbees. There's literally a scene where somebody's head gets cut off. Or they didn't know their head doesn't get cut off, they get like stabbed with a
The guy who made that movie is named like David Sedaris or something. The director
It's not the David Sedaris.
No, it's something like that. But
very inauspicious beginnings.
He made, you know, a half dozen of those things and made lots of money on them.
Yeah.
You know, they're, you know, Playboy models with their tops coming off and violence. That's all in the 80s.
The Roger Corman. I also always liked, did you guys see Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Yes.
That's one of those movies that there's a little bit of weird merit to it, but that's on the list of bad.
I think I'm getting your movie confused with Surf Nazis Must Die.
I've met the lead of Surf Nazis Must Die, too.
You have.
I had dinner with
him. You could
have the weirdest autograph book in the world.
Yeah,
right.
He works with Paris a lot. I had dinner with him a couple times.
Nice
guy, real nice guy.
Nice.
All right, should we do news since we're just over the damn map?
Why not?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't have that many news stories. By the way, this is going to be Zardoz night.
Okay.
Did you
all
just
Zardoz all the time.
Did you just recently watch Zardoz?
No.
It's just on your brain?
It's all the time.
All right.
So John Boorman, who is the director of Zardoz, he, of course, also did Point Blank, Deliverance, and Excalibur. He nearly directed a Lord of the Rings movie.
Really?
Right before
the Silmarillion?
The Lord of the Rings movie.
Wow.
Right before, I think, Excalibur. So he was thinking about wanting to do a King Arthur tale of some sort. He goes to United Artists and says, you know, let's do King Arthur. And then they suggest to him, hey, why don't you do Lord of the Rings instead? We'll give you money to that. And he said, all right, let's do it. So he started planning, and apparently it's been in a book, and they recently did an interview where he kind of explained some of it. He had changed some of the things in the original story. For example, they were going to do a kind of kabuki-style opening to explain the Middle Earth and the making of the rings, kind of like a...
Like no like theater?
Theater type of thing to explain the whole, you know, all of that. Frodo was going to become intimate with Galadriel before gazing into the mirror.
Oh, my.
They were going to have like kind of a love scene. They were going to expand Gimli's character. Gimli's beaten to utter exhaustion to revive his unconscious ancestral memory, giving him special insight into the ancient dwarven kingdom. So he somehow taps into his, I don't know.
Okay.
You're looking at me like, I wrote that.
I am blaming you.
Then there's also a dueling swords of Gandalf and Saruman. Apparently they're going to have a big dueling sword battle between the two wizards.
The hell with the staffs. Sword time.
And they didn't have money for...
Picturing like a switchblade staff thing going on.
Yeah, just like a Sharks and Jets sort of situation. Or just... Christopher Lee.
When you're a gray all the way.
Get out of here. This is White's territory.
They didn't have money for flying beasts, so the Nazgul were going to continue to ride horses even onto Pelennor Fields, I guess. So it was going to be a skinless horse. So it was going to be kind of muscle and bone undead horse that they were going to ride, which could have been cool. Mm-hmm. You know, that's okay.
The Clash of the Titans-esque stop motion of a skinless horse.
Probably, unfortunately. So that would have been the early 80s, yeah. I guess, or late 70s when that was done. So anyway, I thought that was funny that it would have been a very different story.
That would have been a very different...
I can't quite picture it.
Very different movie.
Anybody else with a news story?
I fear I am news free today.
Well, I have... This is a little bit of rumors. I love rumors, especially if we can count it as news.
Tell us a rumor, Aaron.
Well, you know, a couple weeks ago, they had the rumor of Brian Gosling and... Who's that Disney kid?
Zac Efron
that may have been cast in the new Star Wars movie being asked.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Ryan Gosling was not asked, or at least turned it down, or is not involved. That's the new rumor. And who knows about what's his nuts.
Right.
But now there is a very strong rumor that Ian McDermott has been asked to join the cast again. So apparently...
Really?
Apparently the evil emperor is not as dead as we think he was at the end of episode
Interesting.
Six.
He seemed pretty dead.
Well, we just saw him fly down the little...
We didn't actually see him die. We
I remember.
Saw his essence explode,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, we saw the skull thing.
It was pretty final.
Well, Luke fell down something that far, and he used the Force to kind of guide him to a pipe.
Yeah, but he didn't explode, did he?
Well, that was his... Maybe it was like chaff, you know, like...
Right. Maybe, like well, when he was going down, he hit an energy core.
Right.
And then continued to
just
bounce down.
Just ricocheted off.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's like a decoy. It's like a Jedi decoy. It shoots out. You go, oh, man, the Dark Lord is dead. He sent out his Dark Lord
I mean,
death
it's true.
Decoy.
Obi-Wan fell a lot over the course of those movies, and he never died, so...
Well, maybe there's also, you know, how we see a ghost version of Yoda and Anakin and Obi-Wan. Maybe there is an equivalent Sith version of that.
I
would buy that. True. I would buy that a lot. Like, because they ain't going to go down easy. Just because they're dead don't mean you'd count them out.
Right.
You know?
All right. We're going to talk about
possessing other people.
By the way, we will be talking about that specific thing later in our discussion, too, about immortality.
Yes.
I want to bring that up. Anyway, these casting rumors are flying around.
Oh, they're
a lot.
Well, the other
they're
one is
like
Batman
crazy.
Right now too. Everybody wants to know who's the next.
Yeah, who's
going to
be the Superman Batman thing?
I know that was kind of like the big news for Comic-Con, but that does not get me jazzed at all.
Matt and I was actually we were talking about this morning. About the idea of doing the Justice League movie and how the Superman Batman thing is sort of
kickstarting it.
Yeah, the Warner entrance into doing a Justice League flick. But I don't know if they are going to be able to generate the same sort of power that the Avengers did. You know, they
why?
Did. Well, because I feel like a lot of those franchises have been rebooted and done so many different ways, so many different times.
Mm-hmm. I don't think people trust them with the brands anymore.
Exactly.
They've damaged their brands
well,
so
Well, Batman
badly.
Right now, is I wouldn't consider damaged.
No.
Superman, I'm not sure where that lives in the general public's mind. I know that a lot of Superman geeks was not happy with the last movie, including me, and this is the reason why I'm not excited about a matchup.
Yeah, no,
I want to get Superman right.
Yeah, I mean, no spoilers, but the ending of the last movie, just it, I was so frustrated with the disaster porn
but
of it.
But, like, let's say they got a good Wonder Woman movie in. Do you think that's enough?
And that's the one that I think is probably the great hope that they will never do.
No, they recently announced that Wonder Woman is a major...
Again.
Well,
again,
they just
how many times have they announced that Wonder Woman's greenlit again?
Well, they just said that, you know, it's something they really feel like they need to... Let's just put it this way. They want to make Avengers money.
Yes.
Okay. The only way to make a movie about Justice League is to have Wonder Woman in it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and it's the same thing with Green Lantern. I mean, Green Lantern was such a colossal flop that do you think... I don't know if they can entice audiences back. Yeah. I don't think he's a popular enough character.
Look at the core lineup.
To get, I mean, I love Green Lantern. He's one of my favorite comic book characters. Mm-hmm. And I hated that movie.
But remember, they've got other Green Lantern. They could get a black... They could start a black Green Lantern.
Oh, they could totally do John Stewart.
John Stewart.
Who knows that? You know, it's still Green Lantern. The brand is damaged. Yeah, the core lineup of the Justice League: Green Lantern, Damage, mm-hmm. John Jones, who? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aquaman, really? Superman, mm-hmm. Maybe Damage. Batman, still core.
Right.
You know, Wonder Woman, virgin territory.
Right.
She is the only hope they have.
I think the only need is
Flash, maybe.
They could do a Flash. I think they need.
Well, because they're doing the TV show. I think if the TV show is successful, they've got a chance.
I think they need only three lock-ins of individual movies to make the secondary characters work in a Justice League movie.
Well, they have their secondary lineups too. You know, like right now they're doing some heavy investment into Arrow. Because that's like the first TV thing they've gotten going in a while that's really hit.
Well, the DC brand, what the way the DC is branding and their whole Heroes campaign that they're doing right now, just sort of it's like their fundraising charity thing that they're doing. I think it's Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Green Lantern, and Cyborg.
Yeah. Okay.
So Cyborg is another one of those characters where, like, if I were to make a Justice League movie, mm-hmm. Cyborg would be the main character. Like, I would go at it through his eyes.
That would not be...
Nobody
would
be
like, who the F is that guy?
Well, again, Cyborg, I not to play the race card, but I really still feel that Cyborg got promoted to that slot because they're like, we need a black character.
And they do. They need some women and then some color in their freaking, you know, it's weird looking.
Well, and the women of the Justice League have always been a little like, you know, the costumes have been questionable. You know, like Hawk Girl is the only one that's had sort of like a fully covering costume.
Black Canary.
You know? Yeah, the fishnets and the bustier.
Leotard.
Yeah, not exactly.
Yeah, okay. Like, it's like superheroes have been good about that. I get it.
The Marvel female lineup is a lot more, like, a little bit more friendly to female costuming. Ooh. Yeah, I'm not going to defend them. It's
even then, you look at that. I mean, with the Avengers, they didn't make a Black Widow movie. You know, she is apparently supposed to factor in heavily to the Winter Soldier movie, mm-hmm. but you know they set up everybody else really. And
there's been
trust Hawkeye and Black Widow.
Yeah, there's been very little trust to female-headed characters. Even like with DC, they did the Catwoman movie, and it wasn't Catwoman. Like they didn't mm-hmm. trust that brand.
The reality is Wonder Woman is the number one female superhero that everybody knows.
Yeah,
in all comic books. Period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And they, I think they know it. I think they know that if they want to get, you know, if they want to get to their version of the Avengers and they want to set up a pipeline of four freaking superhero movies a year.
Yeah.
She's got to be one.
I think that, I mean, if they're going to do it, they kind of have to take the New 52 DC style of her.
Where she's like an Amazonian badass.
Yeah, you know, is wearing jeans instead of, you know, the weird, you know, swimsuit.
They need to redo the whole thing.
Will never translate to the screen.
Right, and take
I
Christopher Nolan sort of approach to her, make her kind of dark. I have not read the new 52 Wonder Woman, but I heard someone explain it as 100 bullets with Greek gods. I was like, that's something I'd watch.
Mm-hmm. I want to see her fighting Nazis.
What? I haven't read that. Really? 100 Bullets with Greek Gods? That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
I think she's really pissed at Aquaman.
Right.
They're battling.
Oh, really?
It's essentially the battle between... Well, actually, I don't know. That was the end of the last... In the Flash that kind of mixed everything up, it was essentially...
The Flashpoint storyline before they did the whole reboot?
Yeah, it was... The Amazonians versus the Atlanteans.
Oh, okay.
It was full-on war going on, destroying the entire planet. And in the New 52, if I remember right, they're still not all friendly.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know.
See, I've just heard speckles of rumors. I've been avoiding the New 52 because...
Yeah, I'm not absolutely sure on all that, but that's what I can remember.
I actually liked the 90s reboot of Wonder Woman. Like, I liked that. I thought it was a great concept of the diplomat, coming what to the
90s version. Oh, you mean the comics?
Yeah, the comics version.
Oh, okay.
The concept was that basically Themyscira, I can never pronounce it. Is that right? Themyscira?
Themyscira? Yeah, yes.
Yeah, the Greek island of Amazons.
Oh, okay.
Basically make first contact with the modern world,
mm-hmm.
and she comes across as an ambassador. And she has all these powers, and she's literally trying to make contact with a civilization that she considers to be absolutely barbaric.
Right.
And so she's almost representing as a civilization that is the Federation.
Right. Coming to
interesting.
Yeah. But she's a warrior badass with all of those capabilities, trying to convince us to take on these more pacifistic ways. But every time we cross that line, she puts us down, you know, and it was a really nice take on it.
Interesting.
They did something five, six years ago with her where they sort of gave Diana this Clark Kent-esque personality, but she worked for like a spy agency. So she was like a government agent in her regular life, and then Wonder Woman as well. And
well,
I thought
that was straight out of
going back to the 1940s.
Yeah, but I thought that was a really interesting way of doing it, because it kind of made, you know, where we know Clark Kent is just sort of being a nebbish, slubby, mm-hmm. you know, guy. Diana Prince was not. Like, she was tough in her secret identity as well, and I thought that was really a
cool.
powerful choice.
They did, remember they upped in the TV show, they went from 1942 to
the 70s.
To the 70s in one jump, and they did the whole, she worked for the, like, ISO or some weird three-letter organization. And they did the same type of thing where she was like a secret agent by day and a superhero by night. Anyway... Yeah. Was that news?
I think that's news.
Is that considered news?
That was totally considered news.
All right. Let's move on to our main topic.
Da-da-da-da.
So the topic this evening is immortality.
Immortality.
And how it fits into our geek world,
mortality.
Really.
Mortality.
Hey.
Were there mortalities in
I hear one more voice.
Wait, huh?
There is one more voice.
Did anyone else hear that?
Hi, I am Matt King, an actor and director here in Hollywood, and I am a geek.
Matt
and
showed
I am
up.
my children were vomiting all
Did
over
Did you remember
everything.
To turn on the volume?
Yes. Wait, speak, Matt.
I or have forever hold my peace? Yes? No?
Alrighty.
It works.
Perfect.
Excellent.
So we were about ready to start immortality. This one is a doozy of a topic.
Well, it's a long one.
There's a lot of ins and outs, a lot of what have yous.
I guess it started because you had gone to see Wolverine. I haven't seen Wolverine yet, but I said, hey, well, maybe we should do a immortality Wolverine. And then we just said, let's just do immortality. We can talk about Wolverine, but I mean,
I feel like this is probably one of the most popular topics in sci-fi.
Well, in anything, in all of human history.
Yeah, in all of human history. Yeah.
Trying to find a way to cheat death.
Yeah, I mean, the Fountain of Youth, the, you know, deities.
Yeah. All of the monkey myth is monkey charging into heaven to get the peach of immortality or to study
it
with
seems
matter,
to be
Master Subodhi.
It seems to be the thing that man is constantly searching for. And obviously, the fear of mortality is haunting us through our lives, and so I guess it is not strange that we write about it and make movies about it and sing about it.
Wouldn't it be nice if we just had three or four lifetimes to not screw it all up?
Yeah.
So we probably do. We just aren't aware of it.
Right. Yeah, talk to an animal that only lives a couple years, and he's like, what do you guys, how many freaking years you guys?
True.
You know, bugs that live a day.
Yeah.
Their entire life cycle is 24 hours, but to them, I'm sure it's an eternity.
Right.
So let's define immortality. So we're talking about a biological infinite lifespan, right?
Okay.
We're not talking about reincarnation. We're not talking about afterlife.
We're not talking about... talking about invulnerability, too? Impossibility
to be
killed?
I think these are all topics, because really, you know, most of the time when we talk about immortality, we're only talking about the existence, or, you know, you're continuing life from here on out.
Okay, so we're talking about a continuing consciousness.
Yeah, because
okay,
you know, this is going to get a little loosey-goosey, because you know there are some things, even characters that end up being gods, that deal with immortality all the time and other elves and that type of stuff. You,
if well, someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
So, types of immortality. Undead, unaging, there's the spiritual immortality a la Jedis.
Right,
right.
There's the superhero immortals.
There's the brain in the machine.
Yes, the singularity.
Right.
Which is...
Right. And those, you know, there's hundreds of...
I love that concept, actually, in... Parasitic. In Ender's Game. Because Ender has a...
We're not right now.
Not in the.
Oh, sorry.
It's not in the.
It's not
book.
In the first book.
It's not in.
It's
book.
In the first book. Okay. It's in the.
It's
later
like
book.
A whole other.
So I'm spoiling
story.
Another book.
Okay, I'm not reading that one, so it's fine.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is like the how we view immortality, because there's stories about the positive aspects of immortality, and then there's always the negative stories about immortality, and then there's all that neutral area. You know, well, immortality has been. You know, couched as kind of punishment and curses in some stories.
Yeah. Go
this
ahead,
is
Dan.
The one that I always find very interesting. It's like, it seems like the concept of immortality being a bad thing directly is sort of a modern convention. Now, your immortality being used against you is implicitly exists in mythology. So like Loki being imprisoned underneath the dripping fang of the serpent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Prometheus being tied to the rock and having his
being
liver
eaten destroyed. By the rock. Yes. Yes.
You know? Monkey being Sisyphus. Trapped under the mountain for
was it Sisyphus forever. Who has to push up the rock forever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
It's like being trapped in your prison forever.
So are those allegorical ways of saying? Enjoy it while you got it, or, you know, or are they other allegories? I can't remember. Never mind. All right, I'm just musing.
You know, but those are things being done to the immortals, and it's never really stated outright that saying that or immortality sucks. They're never really questing to end their existence because of it.
What like, about the the man who strikes Jesus and is cursed to walk the earth.
The wandering Jew?
To walk the earth. I mean, they never specifically say why that's a curse. And he could be in this room right now.
That's true. Change identities.
Now, speaking as the only half-Jew in the room, hello!
We know, we winnowed it down really quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there we go. I mean, he's an immortal, and he's sad.
I mean, that's just another example.
I'm not biblical enough to actually know the answer to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I loved the Vampire the Masquerade use of the biblical myth, where they basically said, with the first sin, Cain was marked, and basically the first vampires came from Cain. Is that Cain's the mark of Cain was actually the mark of the vampire, and so all of the other vampires successively in that storyline were generational closeness to Cain.
But the strange thing about the Bible, strangely enough, I'm reading the Bible right now, that the punishment of mankind is that there's two trees. You have the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. The tree of life. There is no death.
Yeah, that the punishment of mankind is death. Until they were banished from the garden, Adam and Eve were innocent and immortal.
Yes, like,
that was
death was
the
not
beginning.
Part of the cycle.
Dumb, innocent, and immortal.
But one of the things that Matt brings up indirectly with that statement is the other part of the curse of Cain with these vampires is that they're really cursed never to get along with each other. They're cursed to forever be lonely because they can't stand to be with each other forever, which is another modern convention. As our lifespans got longer, we see that these marriages hardly ever last throughout an entire lifetime.
Right.
And so that sort of brushed off onto our picture of immortality. When you have immortals living together, if marriages can't last 70 or 80 years...
Are you saying hell is people?
Yeah, hell is other people.
Hell is other immortals.
Well, it's interesting. So a lot of the times now, I'm thinking alphas, I'm thinking Vandal Savage. We use immortals as the ultimate foil, as age is just, you know, another superpower, another weapon. You know, they don't necessarily have that many other abilities, but that extreme age turns them into
They're powerful because they will be around forever.
Yeah, I mean, even Highlander, even though Connor McLeod can live forever, most of the other immortals are
Well,
nasty.
With some of those things, I also question if that's because of the youth culture we live in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Immortals become sort of the ultimate picture of the conservative, of the establishment, of what has always been around. And so it is up to the young to overthrow the old.
Interesting.
So that really just becomes sort of a symbol
right.
of something
else. Then you get into the technicalities of immortality. I mean, you look at example Wolverine, mm-hmm. where you say, okay, Wolverine has a healing factor, and he right. ostensibly could live forever because his cells are constantly regenerating.
Now, is he but effectively an immortal?
But he reached a certain age. So is he aging slowly? Like... Mm-hmm. Has he...
Well, same thing with Superman, essentially.
Right.
He kind of slows down.
Well, is that the... I never know that with Wolverine. What's canon? Is that he's aging slowly or that he's immortal?
It's
hard to say.
Yeah.
Like, if you... It sort of depends whose comic you're reading.
Right.
In some of them, he looks like he's been the same damn age since the 1920s, I think, is when he first shows up. I could be wrong.
That they say the first on the timeline?
Yeah, I don't really know for sure, but like I think that's the first.
I mean, I know a lot of people that Wolverine Origins thing that they did, I feel like a lot of people that are comic book fans just kind of ignore that. They sort of push it under the rug.
Well, in the Highlander, immortality started after your first death.
Okay.
So you aged normally until your first death, and then that's when you froze. I don't know if there's some equivalent with the Wolverine thing, that maybe something happens in his life or he just hits a certain age in which he slows down. I don't
his
know.
His origin story? No.
I don't know if he was a 6-year-old for 50 years.
That's where Sabretooth was his brother, right? In the origin story?
It was like a Civil War.
Yeah. Ugh.
I'm trying to remember which book series it was. I want to say it might have been a Piers Anthony series. That's embarrassing.
Hey now,
but
Lake Okeechobee.
Yeah,
how could you not love that?
But I think it might have been the Infinite Adept series. But it was a portrayal of immortality that I kind of liked, and it explained the aging process rather well, where it was your concept of self dictated the age that you reached. And it was sort of it was an aspect of convenience for the writer, I think, but for them to basically make it so that all of the immortal women were really hot and young,
and all the guys were old and wise.
Yeah.
So it was basically that the Matrix thing where they say this is your mental picture and that's what's being projected into the computer.
Yeah,
Matrix has essentially kind of an immortality. Do we know that the people in the vats are aging at all?
Well, yeah,
it must be because
we know
they're babies.
There are babies,
at some point.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, the people in the vats are batteries,
right,
so they're
right.
essentially being used up until their energy is gone.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then they just go and party. And
then they get turned into sludge and fed to the other babies.
Now, you just saw Voyager.
Yeah.
Do you remember the episode, I think it was called Death Wish, in which the other Q shows up and he wants to kill himself?
Yeah.
Great. That's one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. I've talked about it before on this show, but they talk about immortality being a curse because after you experience the universe several times, you're bored.
You're bored.
He was a poet, and I think episode explained that Qs used to be just mortals like humans, and they kind of slowly evolved and became that.
Yeah.
And now,
that's a very fascinating sequence where they use allegorical images because human brains can't contemplate the Q continuum. And so he's literally like walking. I think it's like a Western street.
It's like a truck stop in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he brings them out there and he basically shows him like, you know, two people on the front porch.
Not speaking.
A pinball machine, tumbleweed going by, and he's like, I've been her, I've been him, I've been the pinball machine, I've played the pinball machine,
I've had
the tumbleweed.
We've had every conversation there has ever had a thousand times.
It's one person just reading like a blank book or something like that.
It was like they're reading like something called like the news, and it was like a little flap of paper with like three things written on it. And it's just like, we've experienced everything there is to experience. We're immortals, and we've experienced it a thousand times, And I've written every piece of poetry there is to write. I want to die. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was a great episode to kind of show what crap life it would be to have.
It's really fun.
Yeah, no, the idea of an immortal life scares me more than death.
Really?
The idea of living forever. Because it also, it takes away the immediacy of life. It takes away the consequence.
I don't need that pressure on my life. I would love to knock out a couple more lifetimes.
Yeah, see,
what would you differently?
Like the idea of,
I wouldn't have to do anything differently. I can just keep going.
But the idea of you only getting
one. Would you just keep on graphic designing?
Drive, yeah, forever. You know? Going to work. Just going to work every morning forever.
I'm an immortal toll booth operator.
But I think it is sort of a modern concept. Like we've learned the fear because I think we're presented the fear in so many ways. But I don't think somewhere along the way we've lost sort of the beautiful idea of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to bring it up because I'm having a hard time grasping what it might be right now. But
the pantheon of deities.
Yeah.
So just look at the Greek pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
They are fallible. They make mistakes,
mm-hmm.
but they are constantly beautiful and mm-hmm. will always be that. So it's the question.
But
they
also have been birthed. They haven't lived forever yet.
Right. Well, the Chinese side of the deities that you have the seven immortals. Yeah. You have everything, and immortality goes hand in hand with enlightenment.
I think
you have to have one. You know, if you're going to have the other, you have to study. Mm-hmm. In order to reach immortality in the Chinese way. And I actually kind of like that. I kind of like that idea that it's not
so
something
that
you just
it's not a privilege,
get.
It's an achievement.
It's an achievement, which is very Chinese.
Well,
but,
I think all... I mean, that's kind of how a lot of religions work. Like you know, you strive and strive to be perfect, or in some, you know, like it might be to be Jesus-like, and if you do it, you know, well enough, then you become immortal somewhere else.
Yeah, that's the evangelical, like, if you accept Jesus into your life as your personal savior, you'll live forever. And
yeah.
It's like, even though it's a metaphor.
What?
Huh?
But yeah, I think that's, the promise. People were scared. I like the Middle Earth... you know, elves are immortal in Middle Earth.
Right.
It's not a curse, but it's also not really considered something that, like, the mortality of humans is something they talk about as being a positive thing. And I think that's interesting. In fact, they...
Except when it comes to my daughter.
Well, but that they bring that up in the movies, and I'm starting to... The movies and the books are now fusing together. I can't really remember which is which.
Call Stephen Colbert.
In the movie, maybe the books, there the Elrond tells his daughter, let's imagine what it will be like if you want to live a life with a mortal. Mm-hmm. And that's where the curse comes from. It's not her being immortal.
Right.
It's her being paired with a mortal. It's
even though he's long lived. Right.
Yeah. You will watch the people you love die over and over and over for the rest of all eternity.
I'm watching the second season of Alphas, and I love that there's this moment with the bad guy, basically, and he's there with his great-great-granddaughter,
mm-hmm.
and you don't realize that until the end of the scene, but he's there with her, and he basically says, you know, I've buried 64 great-grandchildren, and he's like,
no wonder he's a bad guy.
He's like, but I'm glad we got to connect.
But
as a side note, the second season of that show is so much better.
It's
than
so
the
much
first.
Better.
So much.
It's
better.
So much better. It's like,
and
the first
I swear
season
to God, I think they had a bug in my living room because they did everything I told them.
Oh, really?
They needed to do to fix that show.
Change this, do this.
Get rid of
this character.
I do like the fact that immortality in itself isn't bad in that aspect. Mm-hmm. It's immortality and mortality mixed, which is the real curse. Right. I think that's cool.
But again, the fact that his grandchild, his descendant, dying
mm-hmm.
is a moment of pain for him.
Yeah.
Means that her life was a moment of beauty for him.
Right.
Which means that he still has the capacity for joy.
Right.
Which means that his immortality still has the capacity for good things.
Right.
Well, but also poses the question, if life is precious and loving someone is beautiful, when they die, a part of you dies with it. if you cannot experience that for yourself, like enjoying the beauty of life for what it is, because death isn't a consequence, does that make immortality a punishment?
Interesting that you bring that up.
Curse?
That is questionable.
Remember,
that's a good question.
Battlestar Galactica had the theme of, we had Cylons that were immortals.
Mm-hmm.
And they, at the end of...
Before they became a soap opera.
Well, in the middle of the soap opera, part of it is right. when they blew up the humans blow up the immortality machine,
right.
essentially.
Yeah, so they can't
and
clone themselves.
It changes them. The mm-hmm. whole that the theme yeah. is that their lives become more important, and they change the way they feel about themselves and others, specifically because they know, holy, like they can feel the
right. They realize that they're finally expendable,
yeah. right? And others are
yes.
They can empathize easier when
absolutely.
I think that's another great. To me, that's great science fiction yeah. when you can write something like that.
Yeah. Have you guys read the Culture novels by Ian M. Banks? There's a fantastic one that I read recently where basically races within his universe, once they reach a certain level of enlightenment and they can live forever, they go to a different universe. They basically tune out. They're like, they're basically the Q continuum. You know, mm-hmm. we've done it all here. We're going to go to a different universe where things are better and we can function.
New stuff.
So there's this whole... species that's about to do that, and there's always a client species that's sort of helping them on their way. And in this one book, basically, as they're helping them on their way, there's a big fight, and one of the spaceships of the ancient race is blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole story is from the point of view of a female of that species who doesn't know whether or not she really wants to go into the dark, but she has to find out why this kerfuffle happened at the last second. And the only person who has the answer is a guy who's been around for 8,000 years. And he's a human being. And he's a human being who was around right when the initial treaty was made between the old species and the young. And the cool thing is when they get to him, when they finally find him, he doesn't have enough capacity in his brain to have stored all of his life. So
he's filled up all the...
Well, he started to fill up his body with them. So, like...
He's filling up his body with memories?
With memories. So, like, his left hand is an engram of his experiences from when he was 105 to when he was 205. All of his love experiences are engrammed on his heart. You know, it's like... So each individual part of him is a different...
I have trouble remembering what I did last week.
Right. Well,
so you should start working on your coccyx.
Yeah.
So,
in
my butthole.
And it's great because then the story becomes basically like it's in my left hand, and I'm missing that digit of my finger, and I don't know why I cut it off because all of the memories are in there.
Right.
So it's fascinating. It's a great book if you get it. Check it out. It's Ian M. Banks and the Culture series.
Hey, I just want to break in here real quickly. Just after we finish this recording, our old friend Smarty Librarian just sent us something, and I want to put that in here right now. So here it goes.
Greetings, geeklings. It's been a long time since I talked to you, but what is time to an immortal? Well, depending on who you ask, it's either a loathsome burden or the first step to eternal happiness. The second step being, naturally, acquire happiness. The first time I ever remember truly thinking about immortality was during an episode of Jim Henson's The Storyteller. It was one based on an old Russian folktale titled The Soldier and Death. The basic premise is that a soldier captures death in a magic sack, and suddenly, nobody dies. But a world without death is not the paradise he imagines, and eventually he frees death. But death is now so frightened of the soldier that death refuses to come and collect his soul. And so the soldier wanders on and on and on, still alive, even today. So, where should you turn if you're looking for books on immortality? The science-minded might want to check out David Boyd Hancock's The Mortal Coil, A Short History of Living Longer. Hancock begins with Sir Francis Bacon, who gave a Christian spin on his experimentations in prolonging life by explaining that it wasn't for his personal gain, you see, but so that one would have longer to continue doing good works. And Hancock ends the book on an optimistic note with the life-prolonging scientists of today. He's not quite Mary Roach with humor, but Hancock makes his scientific history fun and interesting. Manga fans have probably already heard of Tezuka Osuma's Phoenix series, but the rest of you comic book fans should go check it out. Tezuka's classic series zigzags through time and space, each volume taking place in a different era, but all of them focusing on the phoenix, a legendary bird who gives eternal life. There are lady samurais and robots and nuclear war and some beautiful science fiction written by a man who lived through the horrors of World War II in Japan. I highly recommend it, even if you're scared to read manga. For a different twist on immortality, there's Octavia Butler's Patterner series. Start with Wild Seed, the story of two immortals, a mind-hopping freak who spent hundreds of years breeding a master race, and the woman with perfect control over her body, whom he discovers in one of his quote-unquote seed villages. Butler digs deep into moral issues and sociology, as well as African mythology and genetic science, and she keeps you turning the pages. Last but not least, for a book that's just a good bit of space opera, check out The Skinner by Neil Asher. Sable Keach, dead but not dead, is on the hunt for a deadly criminal on an ocean planet. Giant bugs, seafaring voyages, giant bugs, deadly eels that give you an immortality virus so they can feast on your regenerating flesh forever. You know, the usual. That's all from me, my dears. I'll see you in the future.
We go through, it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of the negative stuff written about immortality.
Well, I like that Don brought up that that's a recent thing, because I didn't put that together. I've basically been going, oh yeah, immortality is just bad guy stuff, right? But it
if you think about it, when you go farther back, you know, it was indirect, mm-hmm. but for the rest of us, it was something to be aspired to,
right?
You know, the apples of the gods of Asgard were things that you tried to steal. You wanted that.
Right.
The ambrosia of the gods
was
something
that I mean, still, it doesn't even go that far back. I mean, the romantic poets talked about immortality.
Yeah, but then they ended up paying for it somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same story. You know, we have you know, so-and-so going, Indiana Jones, same thing, going after the Chalice of Life, the Holy Grail, and then, of course...
You're entering the modern era at that point.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying those are the same type of stories, really. It's like you go after the apple and you pay for it then, or you go after the Holy Grail, you pay for it now.
It's like you go after the Holy Grail, you're stuck in the cave. But you live forever, but you can't leave.
Are there good stories where, you know, where...
He twos.
Sure, the hero is being cast into the stars to live forever.
Doctor Who?
Yes.
Doctor
Well, that's what's... I actually really enjoy what they do with Doctor Who. I mean, I know it's a device, but because when he regenerates, he becomes a completely different version of himself, even though he still has those memories, and it's a painful experience. It shows that even though he's an immortal, it gives him... fear. It gives him power and it gives him respect for life.
You know, he ever pay for immortality? Does it ever come up that there's a downside to it?
It's agonizing.
It's
just the transformation though.
Well, it's
so
painful,
like he gets
but
like, you
there
know, there's like
cost.
10
it's,
minutes.
Well, and it's constant. And it's always discussed that much like an immortal watches all their people die is that as a Time Lord, he is cursed to be lonely. Like
but does he ever feel? I've never seen him say I'm lonely. In fact, he kind of is that kind of sexless.
If you watch it, it's just clear.
It's oh, yeah. It's, I mean, it's towards done. the end of the David Tennant seasons, when he finally loses Donna, his companion Donna, and she's her memory has been wiped. You know, he's asked what happens to them, and it's like they go away.
Yeah, there's another one.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not even that there's another one. It's like, he essentially is like, I fall in love with these people, and they can't be with me.
Right. Okay, so they address it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Interesting.
Now, out sort of inside baseball, with the new Doctor series, I mean, used to be that the Doctors would be replaced. They would die off as the actors were leaving their contract and going to another right. job.
Which are a brilliant device.
Yeah. Are they still, because, I mean, that's why Tom Baker was six or seven seasons and other guys were two.
Right.
Right.
Now, are they still doing that, or are they basically saying 2 years and you're out?
I don't know. I think it's the same thing where people will be the Doctor as long as they want to be the Doctor.
Yeah.
But they're also writing in hints. Like, I just finished the Tennant seasons. Like, I haven't
How long was David Tennant?
David Tennant was the Doctor for four years?
Three, I think.
3 years?
Oh, wow.
Maybe four.
And then Matt Smith was the Doctor for 4 years, and they're just replacing him in this next season.
Right.
But what they're building in is that they're showing characters as they travel through time who have met different versions of the Doctor that haven't happened yet.
He is.
That's interesting.
There's a character that he basically has a love affair with, where
the Doctor.
I didn't know
the Doctor.
The first time you meet her is the end of their relationship. And then as you experience her through the
River Song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you go through their relationship, you, as the audience, are experiencing their relationship in reverse. And it's heartbreaking. It's beautiful and heartbreaking. You'll get to some of these points.
Yeah, well, the first time you meet her, I mean, it has a lot to do with the actors involved are fantastic.
Yeah.
But you see that. Essentially the end of their love affair before he even knows who she is.
You'll reach a point,
and it's heart-wrenching.
You'll reach a point where basically it's beautifully done, where she kisses him and she realizes that this is the last kiss she will ever have because it's his first. You know, it's just a beautiful moment.
I'm going to throw out a character that you probably didn't think of when you thought of the immortality discussion. Kenny from South Park.
Yeah.
Never dies, even though he dies.
But they stopped killing him.
What?
Like, the You Killed Kenny thing was a convention of their first, like, five, six seasons.
Mm-hmm. But they got exhausted with
it. But they stopped killing him. Like, in the later seasons.
So he's still alive.
He's still there, but he's
not. What was the first time that they didn't kill Kenny?
I don't know. I can't remember.
I would love to know about that.
They actually just dropped him. They stopped using Kenny for a couple seasons. They replaced him with Butters.
Yeah.
And then they just brought him back, and they just stopped addressing it. And they just don't kill him anymore.
Yeah, I think they killed Kenny for, like, the last time.
Yeah.
And he was just gone.
And he stayed dead for a while. Recently, they did an episode where they started killing Kenny again, and at the end of the episode, his mother gives birth to a new Kenny, and she just puts him in the bed as though nothing happened, and the parents are just like, it happened again. No one must ever know. And they go back into their room.
So they explain how he shows up every time.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah, it was pretty nasty.
God, that's awful.
Some other movies and TV shows that I kind of was searching for. Remember Cocoon?
Mm-hmm.
They kind of toy with.
Oh yeah, you want
living
to? Forever.
Oh, this is the worst fact ever.
Ready? All right, ready for the immortality mind blower right here.
Okay,
I'm scared.
All right, ready?
Let's go ahead.
Okay, Wilford Brimley in Cocoon. Is the same age as Tom Cruise is now.
What? What?
Yeah.
Tom Cruise looks good.
I disbelieve. No.
Dead
no,
true.
No.
Yeah, 50 years old.
He was 50 years old.
I'm rolling a wheel check.
He was 50 years old in Cocoon.
Holy crap.
Remember, like, China Syndrome, he looked old. And that was
Not only that, 10 years
earlier.
Johnny Depp is the same age as Wilford Brimley.
No.
It's like Max von Sydow. You know,
he got to a point where it was like, you've been the same age since 1968.
Yeah, he was like,
I'm going with that whole, like, you become the age you believe you are.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
I want to talk to you about diabetes.
Yeah.
Diabetes.
Death Becomes Her. You know, one of the things I like about that movie.
Oh, Meryl Streep's worst film.
I like
film.
That take on
is
it.
Even and though you're immortal, your best. Body is still yeah. damaged.
You got to take care of that body.
So mm-hmm. you just start falling apart.
That's great.
Yeah, that your body can still age even though
like that's the
you
curse.
Can't die.
Well, no. Your I don't body think can be aged. Broken. It just so if like yeah. if you chopped off your hand, you just
you would lose your hand. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah you
or you
break,
get a hole
you break your arm.
Your
it's never going to knit together again.
Yeah. It doesn't heal. It right. literally yeah. just yeah. you're zombified, but kind of look. You're like a really good looking zombie.
Yeah. yeah.
There's a great character in the Nightside series called Dead Boy, and basically he's just like that. Every time you know he gets, but he just he uses a lot of duct tape and staples.
How about worm bodies? After they come back to life, are they still dead? Or
well, I have zombies. I have zombies on my list as okay. a version of immortality. It's just like an awful version.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing is with zombies, though, is that even though they're the living dead, they continue to rot. So, you know, the theory that older zombies can't walk because their muscles have deteriorated.
Right.
Or and also the thing that's like that has been proposed in a bunch of movies that if zombies don't feed, they die.
Right, right.
Did you? You're talking about the warm bodies, the Romeo and Juliet one.
Yeah.
Right? Did you like that?
No,
you didn't. I liked. It.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was cute. Cute.
I thought it was cute. Cute movie.
But to pair up with exactly. Death Becomes Her, let me bring out the Anne Rice vampires.
Oh. Dark that, chocolate think, with some dark chocolate.
Well, I know. I think that's another interesting concept because they're the flip version of the Death Becomes Her. Where their bodies stay fine forever, but their minds cannot age and change.
Oh, so they're going mad?
Yeah, basically the concept behind her vampires is they cannot change with time. They cannot change with the world.
But
so
doesn't Lestat change with the world a
no.
little bit?
Yeah. Well, in her later book he yeah. does. But
well,
in the
and
interview
in Interview with a Vampire, the movie, they showed that the Kirsten Dunst character, like, even though she stayed in a child's body, her mm-hmm. mind aged and she became a woman, so she yeah. couldn't do anything about
it. Oh, she
that.
Was...
Ew.
Yeah, it was awful.
You know, but the whole reason why he makes Louis in the movie mm-hmm. is because he can't cope with the changing times. Vampires make new vampires in order to help make those new vampires, make them cope with new time periods.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then that's why when Louis finds him at the end, he's hiding in the house because yeah. he's so scared of the new lights and the sounds and this new world outside the
Which
house
makes sense.
Is so terrifying to him. And that was the concept behind Interview with a Vampire at first. And then she was like, I just like this sexy vampire I've made. He's now a rock star. And she just went to town.
Right.
But I thought that was a more interesting concept than what she went
No, I mean, that's an interesting yeah. thought to think that the world is changing you around you mm-hmm. and you can't deal with it. That right. it's like you
yeah,
don't you
immortality
don't understand
makes you
it.
Yeah, I think of my grandmother
almost.
With an iPad, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like
Well, there yeah. also is there was an interesting article that was talking about perception of time, which was saying that when you're a child, when summers lasted forever, mm-hmm. you remember that?
Yeah.
It's because they actually did. Because our proportionate time sense, our relativistic time sense in that was in relation to the amount of time that we had been on the planet. And so as you spend more and more time on the planet, things happen faster because they do happen faster in relation to the amount of time that you've been on the planet. So
that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, it was really fascinating.
Not hearing any of the data behind that, it actually makes complete sense.
Which
as
means
a concept.
If you were an immortal yeah. and you lived thousands of years, would days go by in seconds?
In seconds. We feel it, yeah.
You just sit on the you'd like sit down on the couch and it'd be nighttime. You're like, what happened?
Yeah.
And someone would go, well, you're sitting on the couch for 10 hours.
Right. That's fascinating.
Hmm. The Fountain, I really love The Fountain, but, you know.
I disliked The Fountain.
Yeah, just blank stare.
The snow globes in space.
I liked it.
It was a lovely soundtrack.
It's pretty as anything.
Zardoz.
Oh, wow. You just went full retard.
Fairy diapers.
Mythical.
Zardoz. Let's see. 2001. At the end, this is kind of gets into the kind of spiritual strangeness.
What was the space baby? I never read the book.
The book, he turns into kind of like, he evolves and turns into this. In the book,
it's about the evolution of
species. It's about the evolution of species. So you see that the monolith helps humanity evolve. He does it, but you can see the ape evolve. You see human, then makes it into space. And then the next step is that he becomes this kind of star child, and he can he tours the universe and sees things that
they don't really touch on in the movie, which I think he was technologically not able to do in that film. was in the book, the first section is from the point of view of the monolith.
Oh, really?
No.
Yeah, where it's raising up the apes. The apes are
no,
being...
No, it's the point of view of Moonwatcher, the
But they're being raised up. They're being raised up from, you know, and it's testing them. And it's, it's sort of, oh, this one's a smart one. Let's give him a banana. And, you know, it's raising them to sentience.
Okay.
You know,
and they kind of...
It's not just a thing that goes, oh.
Geeks on now with soundtrack.
They try it in that one moment where the apes are kind of touching it, and then the next scene is they find the bone.
Yeah,
that there was supposed to be that, like, oh wait, we just learned something.
Yeah, no,
it was just, hard to kind of hard to get a
convey that.
Well, you know, but at least
there was also Sprock Zarathustra. You know,
yes.
But that kind of brings up the kind of like spiritual, the Jedi that lives forever. Type of immortality, same thing. Star Child's immortality, you know.
So that's
which was the biggest.
Let's look at the
cop out at the end of Episode 3 of Star Wars. Thank you very much. I figured out a new way of communicating beyond the veil. Look, glowy people. Come on.
Wait, that was in the end of Star Trek 6.
Not Star Trek.
I mean Star Wars.
No, we saw them, but it wasn't explained
why we saw them.
It wasn't explained why. Luke just happened to have this ability to see beyond the veil. It wasn't, I leveled up, and I got this new ability, which is kind of the way they treated it in Episode 3.
So in Babylon 5, there was a species called the Soul Collectors that would travel around and find great people. And wait until they died, and right before their moment of death, would collect their souls,
the essence of who they were, and
put them in these little spheres, and then travel to these big vaults and put them into these vaults to be collected in a library for the rest of time. Form of immortality. Now,
is that a prison or
is that a prison? Is that a vault? Is that immortality? What is that?
Which is the episode with Jack?
Jack, that is not that episode, but that
no?
is a fantastic
is that,
episode.
That is a fantastic episode. Is that the soul? Do they still collect his soul? Is that why he's there?
Yes.
Okay.
But
well, I'm tapped out on immortality. I've gone through all my notes.
The list.
Anybody else have anything?
One of my favorite
parasitic immortality.
Love that one.
You know, like Dax in Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
That kind of is like essentially Doctor Who, where you kind of rebirth.
Yeah,
it's kind of a rebirth in a different body and experience a new body that
I
way.
Love the introduction of the Dax character on DS9, where Julian Bashir comes on as this snotty little doctor who knows everything, who's so adept at, you know, youngest doctor, blah, this, that, the other thing. And he runs into Dax, who's doing this mental exercise that's a balance, you know, like maintaining these four things. And she introduces herself as a Trill, and then he's like, well, let me try. And everything just falls to pieces because he can't even remotely maintain the mental stability that she is. And she's just like, you know.
Yeah.
And it's such a great moment. I love that.
Well, actually, the one that we did mention is the robotic singularity. So when you can transfer your consciousness into an android, you know, are you still the same person? Does your consciousness continue to live on?
Well, and how much of your humanity do you lose?
Because
I've always had an
robot.
Issue with that one, because I don't regard that as immortality. I regard that as a copy. You know, like, I don't think that's you. I think that's an image
so
of
So it's
you.
Like a clone of yourself.
Yeah.
But you do think Doctor Who is immortality? Because it kind of falls in the same kind of...
No, that's you. It's the same person.
As long as it's biological, you're saying?
Yeah.
If you actually change physical states?
If I take your brain, right, and I scan it,
mm-hmm.
and I make it image of it over there, you still exist.
I like Don just used wiggle fingers. Like he used the green light.
We need to start filming
the green light.
Yeah.
Does the 3D scan. I knew exactly what you meant. So
I felt like he became a maker bot.
He
so basically, I mean, if
anyway,
I make a robot of you,
right,
and I put your brain in there, do you cease to be? Can you exist in both places at the same time?
Oh my God, this is a whole other topic.
Well, this is David Brin did this. David Brin did this with his book Clay People.
And if the answer is yes, then if you can coexist at the same time, then there is no reason to believe that is you.
Hmm.
We need to get we need to have an episode of who, like, what makes you you,
right?
And get let's go to a college and get a philosophy major philosophy professor.
Let's get a philosophy teacher. Yeah.
Well, because on this, to even a lesser extent, like you're not moving your consciousness into a robot, but look at just cloning. So if you are cloned and it is you, so when you grow up, it is going to look like you. It is going to have your exact same DNA and your exact same brain. Is that you immortal? Because the clone of you is going to be formed by its own experiences. So is that still you living forever, or is that a new person?
Entirely different topic.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
But it's immortality.
But that's like asking, is your identical twin you?
Yeah.
Genetically, it is the same as you, but I think any twin would find that insulting.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. People would consider immortality like cloning myself, I'm going to live forever.
I think the only way somebody could argue that would be immortality would be to literally clone yourself and then take your brain out and put it in someone else and put it in the clone's head. I would accept that as immortality.
Yeah.
Okay, and so the final concept of immortality is basically the ideas that you create and spread, the art that you create and spread that gets passed on to another person.
Is that for us, mm-hmm. we look at Aristotle, Socrates, and those people are immortal, but in 50 years, nobody could know who that is. The Library of Alexandria was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
How many people were considered at that time immortals of ideas who are gone forever?
Right. Well, it was interesting because I was watching this whole thing on Feynman.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a geek and you haven't gone and looked up the Feynman lectures or read them or watched his biography, just go and do it because it's the coolest thing ever. But he was talking about the last years of his life when he was coping with cancer and realizing that it was invasive and it was going to go. He was gone.
He was dead.
And he had this conversation with a guy, and the guy was like, I'm really sad that you're going to go. And he said, yeah, sometimes that gets to me too. But I think there's enough of me and other people now that I get to go on a little bit. And I was like, that's a really interesting concept of immortality.
Like, is that why people have children?
Partially, yes.
Interesting.
I tend to agree.
Interesting.
That they want to pass on themselves and essentially live forever by having a small
piece
of themselves.
That's not what I wanted to do, but interesting. I mean, maybe it's subconscious.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Polluting the world.
To live forever.
Shall we move on to our bit?
Let's.
Now, I'm glad we're doing one of these because I really miss this bit.
I think it literally has been years since we've done
it. And we are going to be doing more because I love this type of crap. I don't know if
since
anybody...
Since I just finished Voyager, it seems so appropriate.
I don't know if anybody who's listening to this actually enjoys any of these things. But I'm
all of us babbling like morons.
I'm completely fine with that. If you just want to shut it off now, that's fine. I enjoy doing this. So
yes.
We are going to do a technobabble. A technobabble is, we have done in the past, is where we present a situation, usually a science fiction or fantasy situation. And then in the spirit of Star Trek and other kind of not the best written science fiction stories,
we solve it using technobabble.
Solve it using technobabble.
Yes.
Okay. So Brad is going to start us off by telling us what the situation is, and then we are going to techno babble our way out of it.
And he will be our judge this evening.
Since I did not write techno babble.
All right. I love this.
Your ship shudders after the exploding planet of Telthar 12 opens up a Qualtranian drop trench, essentially an endless loop of subspace. The loss of engine stability and energy fluctuations sends your vessel spiraling down the rare anomaly. You are faced with a timeless, unaging prison of space and time.
Dun, dun, dun!
Well, it had to be themed on immortality.
Right, absolutely.
Who is going to start this techno battle?
Why don't you go ahead?
All right, I will start. All right, this is... I can never read these correctly, though.
Because you make up so many odd words. I can never tongue twist myself.
Okay. It was months and months of endless tumbling through that subspace called Quantranian drop trench. Our engineers and technicians worked around the clock to find a solution, but the quark subspace radiation field was causing the engines to drain. Then the Telthrian spawning season kicked in. The last tribe of the Telthar 12 we had rescued before their planet exploded was beginning their yearly biological transformation, and the pheromone spores were not being filtered by our life support systems. The pheromone spores began to affect us. We were losing our minds and slipping into a sexual madness. No one could focus. And soon convincing the crew that floating through space in a mindless mass orgy of sexual pleasure for all of eternity wasn't going to help find the solution to the engine drain. God, if I just had a magical pill to fix the ship's ED problem. That's when it came to me. If we could polarize the quark radiation to an opposite flavor, maybe instead of draining the engine, it would charge the engines. We'd have enough power to pull out of the trench. Now, my engineers warned me that if this lasted for more than 4 hours, it could be a problem. But I didn't really believe them, and besides, I figured it would give us something to brag about when we got back to Starfleet. Well, it worked. After 3 weeks in dry dock and 6 months of sexual harassment training, our ship and crew were back to normal.
Wow. All right. Excellent.
Wow. The ship had ED problems.
Yeah. 50 Shades of Space.
Quick, Mr. Qualthar, fire up the tachyon boosters, is the first thing I yell. I'm told that it is impossible and that the engines are slowly beginning a death spiral as their parts phase in and out of existence. Options? My science officer looks over gravely and pronounces that the ship is done for, and that his recommendation is that we head for the escape pods. However, the anomaly is likely to affect their engines as well, and the probability is 53.78564% that we will lose most of the crew. Unacceptable. Suddenly I have a flash of my 16th birthday, the smell of lemon cake and hot dogs, then a vision of my mother reaching in my crib, then my first girlfriend and I arguing over our first apartment. Then back to the bridge. I realize that the crew is all on their knees or flat on the floor, and I realize that I myself have fallen out of the captain's chair. Report! I was experiencing variegated hallucinations of my past experiences, Captain, the science officer reports. I was traveling in my first training vessel, the pilot spouts. The rest of the crew is the same, past images fluttering through our heads. Wham! I find myself holding my son. Then he's grown, and I'm watching him in the Rigelian hoverboard finals. It's all wonderful, except I don't have a son. The crew can't control themselves, falling in and out of strange memories, when suddenly, epiphany. I run for the hyperlift, fighting images of my past and future fluttering through my mind. Mr. Qualthar! Mr. Qualthar! I can't focus, Captain, he spouts at me wearily. I keep seeing my mother's face, and she's been dead for nigh on 30 years. It's the phase loop, Mr. Qualthar. The engines aren't working because we're passing through various time periods where the parts of those engines don't exist yet. We need to isolate the engines in an inverse Falcon-Hawking field to counter the effects. But, Captain, that's not possible. It is if we use the photon emitters to create a null shield around the ship. During that time, we can use the Gorinabulan anti-phase cannon that we picked up from the Harathi ship before they blew up the planet and fire it at the Boroxian crystals to bind together a tri-matrix web which could stabilize us in present space and get us out of the Qualtranian drop trench. Captain,
It just might work, or it could tear us apart.
We'll just have to take that risk. Firing up the Grenoblian cannon, we fire it. The resulting heat burns away a goodly portion of the skin on my arms, but clinging to consciousness, Qualthar and I use the Baroxian crystals to destabilize the current warp phase engines. The ship begins to shudder as we get the engines focused in present space.
That's it, Captain! It's working!
With one last pulse, the Baroxian crystals enter a non-emitting semi-phasal anti-nuance state and return the ship to present space with a snap. The images disappear from our heads and we all look around in relief. The last thought I have before I collapse is, why would my wife name our child Wyatt?
Oh, wow. All right.
Nice. That was some serious techno babble.
Yeah, that was thick.
Mine's a little lighter. I had a false start on this one, so it's a two-parter. All right. This one isn't so hard. Luckily, Aaron wrote this scenario, and he can't spell. So, and I quote, your ship shudders after the exploding planet of Telthar 12 opens up a Qualtranian drop trench. Shutters. Not shutters, but shutters. The lovely wooden things you paint white and put on windows to keep out the sun and the occasional hurricane.
There's a difference?
So since a shutter malfunction is responsible for sending my ship crashing down a rare space anomaly of eternal space-time, here's what I do. I use my sonic screwdriver on the damn hinges to fix them. The end. Or if that isn't good enough for you.
How dare you, sir?
A Qualtranian drop trench is a tricky business, but as most people know, the main threat from one of them is the high levels of chrono particles. Since they're so rich in them, though, you might actually be able to use them for you. So here's what I'd do first. First off, reverse the polarity on your Hendrix shutters and use them to collect the chrono particles. Dithering them in your Marshall Center should whip up the chrono particles into a super agitated state known as the Grunsnick point. Once you've got them there, you direct them around, not through, but around your trans-dimensional transducers and into your Yang-King drives.
They always show up.
Since those Yang-King drives are guaranteed to get you anywhere you need to be at a certain time, anywhere in the universe around 30 to 40 or minutes late, the sheer power should be able to tear you free from the Qualtranian drop trench about 30 or 4 minutes after you try.
That's about right.
Wow. Those are all impressive scenarios. Well, I think Matt wins for sheer techno babble. There was a lot of big words in there. And also some science that I was following. And I was like, yeah, of course the engine is phasing in and out. Yeah, that totally
That was
makes
actually,
sense.
I did like that part.
That was nicely done.
Those
bits and pieces. Aaron, you win for making it a total sex party. I love that. But I'm going to have to give the ultimate award to Don for sarcasm. Because I love sarcasm.
But if you go on Facebook and find this episode, you should post who you thought won the Techno Babble Challenge on Facebook.
Excellent.
You can do a search for Geeks On Podcast on our Facebook page, or you can go to www.geekson.com, and that will also get you to the Facebook page.
Yep. Click on the link.
Exactly.
Have fun. They're Geeks On groups. They're Geeks On stuff. We should also do a mailbag episode soon. So if you want anything that's read on the air, if you have something that you'd like us to talk about that we haven't talked about, write into Geeks On. Write on the Facebook
page.
Why don't
you just ask us a random question?
Or send it in to Matt, Aaron, or Don at geeksOn.com. We got to get Brad an email.
Or geeks at geeksOn.com.
Or geeks at geeksOn.com and let us know what you think.
You know what? Speaking of which, we should clear up something.
Oh, what? Is it my rash?
No, somebody had mentioned on Facebook, and I think it's not that big of a deal. I don't know if I can find it in time, but you had mentioned that you had seen, Jay and Silent Bob actor.
Jason Mewes.
Right, that you had mentioned, he was sitting down with a bunch of beers. Somebody emailed us, said, hey, he's been sober. I doubt if it was a beer. Just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't know if he was drinking it.
I don't know if he was drinking it.
But anyway.
No.
So
just the place where we saw him. Yeah. Don't know what he was drinking.
Exactly. Yeah. So we didn't want to imply that he is, off the wagon.
Right.
So.
Euphemistically drinking a beer.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know whether or not Jay.
Right. You know. Exactly. So anyway, yes, send us emails, ask us questions, chew us out, make complain or give us feedback, whatever, and we will read it.
Excellent.
Anything else before we... This is like an old school show.
This is like an old school show.
I like it.
I do too.
I like it. All right. Anything else before we close it up?
Nope.
All right. No. Good night, everybody.
Thanks.
Have a good geek week.
Woohoo. Rock it out.